I'm wondering if you saw the article, the column by Paul Krugman in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, titled "Science is a Matter of Research, Not Revelation. Why are so few Republican professors? Because they rely on theocracy for their answers." If you read that, you might be thinking the same thing I am. But Paul Krugman says that the reason you won't find, and he's talking about this in political terms, you won't find Republicans in the academy is because they tend to be religious types, and so they obviously don't have, since they depend upon revelation rather than research, they're not going to have the kind of academic credibility. And that's why you won't find them there, because they're Bible people. They're religionists. And I wonder whether or not he's right. Is it a matter of academic freedom? We always say, well, there's not a lot of academic freedom if you won't teach evolution as an equally valid theory alongside creation. Is that the explanation for these things? That one of those views is based in research and the other one is based in revelation. And the twain in the academy never should meet. Dr. Angus Manoush joins us here in this half hour of Issues Etc. to talk about Krugman's article and other matters scientific and religious. In the next half hour, Pastor Mark Chavez, director of a reform group within the largest Lutheran church body in the United States, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, that reform group called Word Alone, joins us to update us on the ELCA's sexuality report that's making the rounds officially. There have been some reactions and some suggestions made by various groups and sectors of that largest Lutheran church body. And we'll talk about what those are and where that report is headed. Then Dr. Harold Tomisch in the third hour of the program joins us for part three of our four-part daily series on the book of Hebrews today, the Lord's Supper in that New Testament book. Dr. Angus Manoush is our guest professor of philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin. He is director of the Cranach Institute, a Lutheran voice in the public square, and editor of the book Reading God's World, The Scientific Vocation. Dr. Manoush, welcome back.
Hi, Todd.
So what are you religious types trying to do? Are you trying to religionize science?
Well, no, not in the sense that they mean. But there's so much hidden in that question, this false dichotomy between revelation and research. First of all, in the background, it assumes that secular humanists don't have any religious presuppositions, that they are perfectly neutral. But, of course, to assume that there is no God or that if there is, it can't have anything to do with nature is just as much a bias or a presupposition as to believe that there is and he might have something to do with it. However, when it comes to providing evidence, we're going to be operating in the left-hand kingdom of reason, and we have to show our evidence. Just because someone has a religious motivation, whether as a Christian believer or as a secular humanist, doesn't let them off providing evidence. What's really going on, though, is that because of this idea now of methodological naturalism, if it turns out that the evidence does point to a designer or to God in some sense, well, then that evidence is somehow ruled inadmissible. So the truth of the matter is that they have biased science by interpreting it according to a secular humanist perspective. They're not neutral at all. If it was really open, a level playing field, then you would be able to have all sides coming from their different religious presuppositions and compete in this area to say what does the evidence really point to.
Krugman mentions the teaching of evolution alongside the teaching of creation and asserts pretty strongly that one of those views, evolution, has its origin in research. The other has its origin in revelation. And the two in the academy should never come together. How do you respond?
Well, basically, he seems, again, to be assuming that it's just sort of independent, neutral study that has led to the idea of evolution, whereas, in fact, it comes from the idea that you explain everything that happens in nature autonomously. Well, that is a very loaded biased assumption. It's an assumption that a deist would make or an atheist would make, but it isn't an assumption that anyone would make if they thought it's possible that God intervenes in nature. So there's no neutrality there at all. And in fact, they're just hiding their religious presuppositions while claiming that the others are the only ones who have them.
Here is a quote from the column by Krugman, and it is he's talking about it in political terms. I want to take your response out of the political realm and kind of view it as a more general indictment of people who are of religious persuasion. This is what he writes. Think of the message this sends. Today's Republican Party, increasingly dominated by people who believe truth should be determined by revelation, not research, doesn't respect science or scholarship in general. It shouldn't be surprising, then, that scholars have returned the favor by losing respect for the Republican Party. Now, let's take that as a more general indictment of people with religious sensibilities. How do you respond?
Well, first of all, I think that the truth of the matter is quite different. It was very religious Christian people who were at the forefront of the modern scientific revolution, and in fact, their belief in providence that led them to believe that there were laws of nature to discover. And furthermore, right now, it isn't just a matter of somehow, as he suggests, religious conservatives not wanting to go in. There are clear acts of intolerance and censorship. You know, McCarthyism is always used as something that conservatives do. But right now, there are egregious examples of McCarthyism in the academy. We had Dr. Richard Sternberg at the Natural History Museum in Washington. After he went through normal peer review and published an article by Stephen Meyer on the origin of biological information, saying that Darwinism couldn't explain it, he was harassed and said he didn't use the proper procedure, attacked. We've seen the same thing with the president of Harvard, Lawrence Summers, when he suggested that there were innate differences in the brains of men and women that might explain some of their different abilities in science. That led to a no-confidence vote. And look at the different way they've treated two professors at Colorado University. Side by side, we have Ward Churchill and Paul Mitchell. Ward Churchill in ethnic studies falsely claimed to be Native American on his affirmative action form. He plagiarized publications, didn't have a PhD, and compared individuals in the World Trade Center to Eichmann, a Nazi. Yet 200 of his fellow faculty signed a full-page ad defending him. At the very same time, we've got Paul Mitchell, a history professor, who won a national teaching award, viewed as the best teacher on campus, and he mentioned the views of some critics of affirmative action, all of whom were black. He himself is the adoptive father of two black children, and he was fired. They never were concerned about his brilliant academic performance, the evidence of how he lived, and nor did they ever consider the arguments against affirmative action that he had mentioned. None of that mattered. So in that kind of environment, it seems to me that conservatives feel unwelcome. That explains why there aren't as many as there could be, because there is a lack of intellectual diversity. There's been a great emphasis on gender and race and other kinds of diversity, but the problem is there is almost monoculture, according to a couple of recent studies. The most recent one by Robert Lichter and Stanley Rothman, showing at elite universities 87% of faculty are liberal and 13% conservative. That's a pretty striking number, and I don't think conservatives feel very welcome, neither students nor faculty.
What are the presuppositions made by those who, the proponents of evolution?
Well, the main presupposition is that everything that we observe in nature must be explainable by some undirected unfolding of things within nature. In other words, you can never look outside. Even if we're surprised by this sudden advent of extremely complex biological information, which seems so similar to, say, Shakespeare's plays or something else, which we normally attribute to intelligent agency. Nope, the rule is it has to be explained only by these blind, undirected processes within nature itself.
Is that what you referred to before as methodological naturalism?
Yeah. Methodological naturalism kind of pays lip service to religious by saying, well, you can believe in a God if you want. But methodologically, it's not scientific to ever mention the possibility of a divine being involved in nature. So no matter what the evidence is, you're saying it can never be allowed to go there.
Now, someone might say, look, science is limited in its method. Therefore, since it is an empirical exercise and things metaphysical, supernatural, and divine cannot be measured, science can't be faulted for not dealing with God, or at least leaving the question hanging as to God. And if they tried to deal with God, then suddenly they're in the very subjective world. How do you respond?
Well, there's a couple of things. It's already going to be metaphysical if you assume materialism, that matter is all there is. So metaphysics is unavoidable. All scientists use metaphysics. So again, it's a false myth of neutrality. Also, when you look at what proponents of modern intelligent design are saying, they are simply saying that you can find empirical evidence that points to a transcendent being. It does not allow you to identify that being. So it's rather like Paul in Acts 17 finding this altar to an unknown God. It's left for the preacher and the theologian to proclaim who that is. It's quite true. That's not a matter for science to do. That's going to give us the identity of God, who God is, and how they save. But science can nonetheless uncover evidence that there is a higher being. And to deny that, to say that it can only ever uncover evidence of materialism, is turning this into a monopolistic conversation. And it's just the same in other areas where people are not even able to discuss the problems with, say, affirmative action. Then there isn't any discussion anymore. Even somebody who is themselves of an ethnic minority can't discuss that issue. That seems to be absurd.
What about what kind of critique can be leveled at this methodological naturalism when it comes to something like information? That is, if the world is nothing but a conglomeration of matter and energy, just two different states of essentially the same thing, in such a universe, could information arise, like the information encoded in our DNA?
Well, a certain amount of information might, but there are limitations on how much information and also how specific it is. A very good example that shows this is the one, of course, that you may have seen on the internet with simulated chimpanzees typing for millions and millions of years. And last time I checked, they had only ever managed to get about a 17-word phrase from one of Shakespeare's plays. Or it happened to coincide with it. The problem is that when you are looking at something like DNA, which specifies life, you're really looking at volumes and volumes of very specific information. And it's like a computer program. It's very delicate. If you upset that information, because this specifies now how various structures are to be built in the organism, then all sorts of things are going to go wrong. So A, it's a massive amount. And B, it's extremely delicate and specific. And lots of research is showing that kind of information simply isn't going to arise either by chance or a combination of chance and necessity, natural law.
I want to talk about the delicacy of that information, because the more it seems that scientists delve into, say, human life at a genetic level, the more they are telling us that this is not just a balancing act, someone walking a tight wire. This is someone walking on an infinitely narrow thread, and they've got to walk all the way from one end to the other successfully every single time. This is very delicate information.
Right, and we see that, for example, in the amazing proofreading that goes on when genetic information is duplicated. There is basically a mechanism that takes the original genetic information, writes it out again, and then it goes back to proofread it, because it's so absolutely important that errors are not introduced. If on occasion that they are almost uniformly going to be fatal, or at least, or at best, non-functional. So that making errors here would be like having errors in a sophisticated computer-controlled assembly production line factory. Anything that goes wrong with those instructions can be expected to lead to all kinds of knock-on errors and horrible products.
Last weekend, I was listening to a science radio program, And they mentioned, I found this fascinating, they mentioned that there is a researcher, in fact, they talked with the researcher himself, who was doing genetic experiments, not on human beings, but on plants.
Right.
And they I don't know if you heard about this, but they discovered that there was a certain kind of plant, I forget what kind it was, that even when the two parents possessed a certain genetic flaw, the offspring somehow were able to have normal genes. And I remember the scientist, the researcher in this case, saying at the end of the interview, we're simply going to have to rethink everything we thought about the way genes work in reproduction.
Oh, this is happening all the time. For years, because of the assumption of this random process of evolution, there's a lot of talk about junk DNA, whose function is now being determined. And also the discovery there are lots of other things besides DNA that are going on. In fact, the machinery is much more complicated than had been thought. So if you look at it as something that arose by chance, one can be quick to dismiss things as not functional or not really doing a very good job. Just as for years, various organs in the human body were thought not to do anything, like the appendix, and then it turned out they do. Design has really been vindicated here, because its assumption is if there is something there, it's probably doing something, even if we can't yet figure out what it is. And over again, that's turned out to be true. So I believe that scientists, even if they'll claim that they are evolutionists, are methodological designists. Because the good scientists will always work with the assumption that what they're seeing has a function, and their job is to decode it. That's the amazing thing. They use that principle regardless of what philosophy they may say.
Let's talk a bit about intelligent design and its reputation in the scientific community. There are obvious advocates for it who are well-known scientists. Is it catching on? Is it gaining credibility at all?
Yes, I believe it is. One of the things that's happening here is around the country, the science standards are gradually being adjusted in fairly modest ways. There are a number of states. Kansas is coming up where they're going to, and we've already had Ohio, some preliminary ones in Wisconsin, where they're coming around this idea that, look, we do need to teach the controversy, even for the sake of understanding the theory of evolution itself. There's something wrong about teaching an idea with nothing to contrast it with, and that you're going to get more curious and better students if they're allowed to weigh the evidence for, against, see possible problems. That, I think, is the future, because you have to change education before you can really start to see a systematic change in science in the future.
Does intelligent design have the inherent advantage in that it is not counterintuitive, whereas evolution at its very most basic logical level is?
Yeah, because it starts from a premise of human design. We see it all the time that what human agents can do is redirect the course of nature. Here's where the river would have run, but it doesn't, because human engineers redirected it. Here's where these rocks would have lain, but they don't, because a human sculpture carved them and put them together in a particular way. And we noticed that intelligence can do this in the human case. What happens if we discover things in nature that look as if they have been very specifically rearranged from just a collection of elements, of chemical elements? We want to know, well, how could that have happened? That doesn't look like the sort of thing that could happen without intelligence. So there is a very intuitive side to it.
How do you respond to those who say, and here with only a minute, how do you respond to those who say, look, the real answer between revelation and research is to find that middle ground, theistic evolution, evolutionary creation, something along those lines?
Yeah, no, I think you have to respect both sides of the compromises tend to end up not respecting either of the sides of the equation. All sides need to be honest about their religious presuppositions. Get rid of this myth of neutrality. There is no neutrality here. And all sides need to then provide persuasive arguments and not get involved in gagging people and preventing them from speaking and ruining their careers and all this other terrible stuff. That's the best way to get truth. Allow the controversy to occur.
When someone goes home tonight, Dr. Manoj, and their neighbor over the back fence says, hey, what did you think about that Paul Krugman piece in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch? How should they respond?
Well, I think they should say that there's a lot of red herrings here. He's gotten away from the real issues. He's claiming to say that there's no bias, but there's tons of it. Go to David Horowitz's site, for example, on studentsforacademicfreedom.org, and he throws around phrases like theocracy, as if every conservative Christian wants Christian government, which we as Lutherans know is not true. They're getting a lot of red herrings, a lot of superficial sound bites that are far away from the real issues.
Dr. Angus Manoj, thank you for being our guest.
Thanks, Todd. Glad to be on.
Dr. Manoj is professor of philosophy at Concordia University, Wisconsin, in Mequon, Wisconsin. He directs the Cranach Institute, a Lutheran voice in the public square, and he's editor of this book, Reading God's World, The Scientific Vocation. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. You can call that number and ask for Reading God's World, The Scientific Vocation, or find out more about the book at www.cph.org. That's the website for Concordia Publishing House, www.cph.org. I loved science when I was in school, but I have to admit I'm no scientist. I do know what makes sense, though. And I think when it comes to the great showdown that will inevitably come, probably in the classroom, between this now long-lived evolutionary theory that's had to be amended and hemmed up and taken in and let out at various places as long as it's been around, and the simple elegance and, in one might even say, ring of truth of intelligent design, as a theory, not as a signpost toward who God is, but a signpost that there is a God, an intelligence behind all this design. I think when that great showdown comes, sooner or later, if we haven't been robbed of our ability to think critically by that time, that the simple elegance and that ring of truth will win out. That doesn't mean evolution's going away. Don't think that for a moment. It's probably here to stay. Too many people have too much at stake in it. Too much of our other ideas in this world have been built upon it, most of them bad ideas. But just in interests of the truth, and all truth is God's truth, just in interests of the truth, it would be nice to have that theory countered by another, equally plausible, perhaps even more plausible theory, like intelligent design. Will that get you to Genesis 1 and 2? No, it's not intended to. But, as I said, in the interest of truth, it would be nice to see that kind of a classroom in the future.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do personal or family devotions have to be something spontaneous, off the cuff, on the spur of the moment? What about personal or family devotions grounded in God's Word and in the historic prayers and teachings of the Church? Is there a resource that brings all of these things together in one book? Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April is called The Lord Will Answer, A Daily Prayer Catechism. This book is intended for personal and family devotions. The Lord Will Answer is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, and ask for the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April, The Lord Will Answer, 1-800-325-3040. Or visit our website, issuesetc.org, and there on the homepage you'll find more information on the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for April, The Lord Will Answer.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Conservatives are spending a lot of attention on making sure the right judges get to the bench. But what about removing jurists who shouldn't be there in the first place? Some congressional leaders are hinting at the possibility of impeaching federal judges as part of the fallout of the Terry Schiavo case. Stuart Shepard reports.
You may recall when Congress called on a federal court to take a new look at the Schiavo case, it took a pass. Kerry Gordon Earl is with Focus on the Family.
Congress has jurisdiction over the judiciary, and they assigned them a task. They said, we want you to go back and look, take a fresh look at Terry Schiavo's cases. And the court basically said, yeah, we get a paycheck from you, but we're not interested today.
While the Constitution established the Supreme Court, every other federal court was created by Congress, giving it some power over what happens in the judicial branch of our government.
There needs to be some serious contemplation by what the role is of the judiciary and what Congress's authority is to try and bring it back under control so that we do have a balance of power. And as people look at that, impeachment may be one thing that is suggested.
She makes it clear that impeachment is not something to be considered lightly.
One of the things that really should come into focus now is reining in the discretionary powers of the court.
Kay Daly with the Coalition for a Fair Judiciary says as we consider who to add to the bench, we might also consider who needs to be removed.
It's not enough to nominate good judges and just hope for the best when they get on the court.
Still, Daly does not think the actions of the 11th Circuit rose to the level of impeachment. For Family News in Focus, I'm Stuart Shepard.
Congressional leaders are discussing options. Meanwhile, Earl calls the situation a constitutional crisis. She says while impeachment is serious, leadership should not be fearful if it's truly warranted. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Hello, this is Kay Meyer of Family Shield. Do outdated means of outreach, inappropriate assumptions about people's faith, and a lack of passion for the lost hinder the church from fulfilling the Great Commission? Join us next time as we talk about new directions and missions. My guest is Reverend Stephen Huey.
Saturday morning at 11 on AM 850 KFUO.
How's your prayer life coming along? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April is a daily prayer book titled, The Lord Will Answer. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this prayer resource on our website, issuesetc.org. The cost is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. The Lord Will Answer, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April.
Here's something I've been watching very carefully. It takes a considerable amount of patience to watch this because it's unfolding very slowly. The whole question of gay ordination and gay marriage, we've talked about it in the Episcopal Church USA, we've talked about it in the UCC, we've talked about it in the United Methodist Church, but I have a vested interest in our Lutheran brothers, the larger Lutheran church body, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and what they're doing with it. I said it takes a considerable amount of patience because both the report on what's happening and what should happen and the recommendations that came from a certain task force within that large Lutheran church body have all been very slow. Kind of putting off the question, let's not talk about it now, let's talk about it later. Well, just got some news the other day that the reaction to this sexuality report in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America has gotten its reaction from the various synods, you might call them districts or sectors of that church, and some of the response to that report is surprising. Some of it isn't. Pastor Mark Chavez joins us here for this 25 minutes of the program. He's director of a reform group within the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America called Word Alone to get us an update on the ELCA's sexuality report. Pastor Chavez, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's good to be with you again.
What has happened lately, the latest news, with regard to the sexuality report in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America?
Well, the most recent news that you've alluded to is the news release from the ELCA Communications Office in Chicago that summarizes about half of the responses from our synod councils. And as you indicated, the news is interesting and sometimes a little bit surprising. But basically, the task force recommendations are not getting a whole lot of support, and especially the third recommendation. Most of the synod councils, even synods that would probably be in favor of a positive answer to the two questions, should we ordain practicing homosexuals and should we bless same-sex unions, have raised some critical questions about the third recommendation.
Okay, let's talk about all those recommendations in order. What does the sexuality report, as it stands, what three recommendations does it make?
The first recommendation is an acknowledgement that the ELCA is deeply divided, but it shouldn't be a church-dividing issue, and the first recommendation calls us for continuing discussion and dialogue and find ways that we can agree to disagree. The second recommendation calls for the affirmation of the pastoral statement from the Conference of Bishops of the ELCA in 1993, in which they said that there's neither support in the scripture or in our tradition for approving the blessing of same-sex union, so they said that we ought not do it, but continue to provide pastoral care for people caught up in homosexuality. And the third recommendation is to leave the current policy in our vision and expectations document from the Church Council of the ELCA, leave that the way it is, which clearly says that people who regard themselves as homosexual should remain celibate in order to serve on the roster of the ELCA as either ordained or in other rostered areas. And that third recommendation says keep the policy the way it is, but then goes on to say that they hope that people in the ELCA refrain from disciplining churches and individuals who may cross the boundary of that policy.
All right, let's talk about these one at a time. But before we do that, again, given what the reaction has been to the report from the ELCA on human sexuality, what direction does it seem the church is headed on this issue?
Well, it looks like the task force recommendations, especially the third one, are in trouble. The Church Council of the ELCA actually meets this Friday through Monday. They're the ones who finally have the responsibility to decide what to forward to the churchwide assembly this summer in the way of a formal resolution. I would be very surprised if they recommend the approval of the three recommendations as they came out of the task force. There are conversations going on among ELCA leaders about trying to find some wiggle room or some space, is the word that they're using, in which there might be some exceptions or some way to allow for some of these things to happen. But I think the task force recommendations, and especially the third one, that one's in trouble.
On this first recommendation, to acknowledge that that the church is divided on these subjects of the ordination of homosexuals and the blessing of same-sex unions, but not to recognize it as a church-dividing issue, mm-hmm. That seems a hard case to make when you observe the Episcopal Church USA and what they recently went through on gay ordination and now same-sex union blessings. There was not just disagreement, there has been formal division.
Right. Yes, I don't accept the argument that what's at stake here isn't potentially significantly divisive for any denomination. Because finally, what's at stake is not just the question of whether or not a denomination would approve the blessing of same-sex unions and ordain practicing homosexuals, but really what's underneath this is the question of the authority of the Word of God, and in particular, the authority of Scripture in the life of a church.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I mean, the central question, which the task force didn't answer, and they admitted that they didn't answer it, is whether or not homosexual activity is sinful. The task force has conceded that the scriptures, Old and New Testament, consistently prescribe proscribe homosexual activity, but they then don't go on to answer the question, well, is it sinful or not? And if it if the scriptures consistently proscribe it, then the answer of Christians for 2,000 years worldwide has been, yes, it's sinful activity, and we should not engage in it. And I do not see how you can have within the same denomination one side saying with the scriptures it's sinful activity, everybody ought to avoid it, and we ought to minister to people who are caught up into it and help them be set free if possible, and the other side saying there's nothing wrong with it, this is the way God made some people, we ought to bless it and celebrate it. I don't see how those two positions can stand side by side within the same denomination.
Does this first recommendation operate on the principle that heresy is to be preferred to schism?
No, actually, there's a news release now maybe about a week and a half old from the ELCA, which quotes our presiding bishop, Mark Hansen, who in turn is really quoting Professor Craig Nesson from Wartburg Seminary in Iowa, in which they acknowledge that there are irreconcilable differences on this matter, but they stem from what Craig Nesson calls two legitimate paradigms or two legitimate ways of interpreting Scripture that reach opposite conclusions.
But they would seem to be mutually exclusive paradigms. If one paradigm says God forbids homosexuality, ergo the church ought to deal with it as sin, and the other paradigm says, well, God may forbid it, but the church shouldn't deal with it as sin, those would seem to be mutually exclusive.
They would, except that I think underlying Craig Nesson's work and probably our presiding bishops is the underlying assumption that in this day and age we can no longer say that there are absolute truths.
The underlying
assumption is that there are truths for some people in some times and places and truths for other people in other times and places, and even though they are irreconcilable in terms of coming out in opposite places, that's okay.
It would seem then if that is going to be the prevailing guide to how the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America deals with the truth regarding human sexuality or any other truth,
well, that's
this is
hope.
A church truly adrift.
Right. Yeah, that's the hope of many of our leaders, but it remains to be seen whether or not the members of the ELCA would actually agree with that and affirm that position.
What about the second recommendation? What does the consensus of the church at this point seem to be on affirming that 1993 statement by the bishops where there will be no support for same-sex unions?
Well, most of the responses, but not all, have said that, yes, the pastoral statement from the bishops should remain as is. There are others who have said that there are problems even with that second recommendation, because although it affirms the pastoral statement of the bishops, it's interpreting that pastoral statement in a way that was never intended by the bishops who signed it in 1993. The intention of those bishops in 1993 was to say there's no support in Scripture or tradition for doing this, we ought not do it, but that doesn't mean that we turn people caught up in homosexuality away from our churches. We continue to welcome them. We continue to speak the gospel to them and speak the truth in love, and we minister to them. But over the years, not only the Conference of Bishops has changed, but many of the churchwide leaders, and they're now interpreting that the end of that 1993 statement, and especially the language about pastoral care, to mean that it's okay if some churches go ahead and do this.
That is, perform same-sex unions.
Yes, and yes. And clearly, even though the recommendation itself from the task force doesn't say it's okay to do this, the language in their report surrounding their recommendation clearly leans in that direction. And I mean, the majority of the task force is obviously in favor of blessing same-sex unions.
We're
but they couldn't recommend it because they didn't get the support for it in their responses to their own study.
We're getting an update on the sexuality report that's making the rounds in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. Pastor Mark Chavez is our guest director of a reform group in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America called Word Alone. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. In the next hour, part three of our four-part series on the book of Hebrews, we'll talk about the Lord's Supper in Hebrews with Dr. Harold Tomasch. Pastor Chavez, the third recommendation, I don't even know what to, I think you heard me sigh deeply when you summarized it for us. I don't know what to make of this. That is, we leave in place this policy, not to ordain gays or lesbians, but if someone does, we're not going to discipline them.
Mm-hmm.
What is that about?
You know, even leaders in our church who are completely in favor of a positive answer to those two questions have raised the same concerns as you. I mean, it clearly is not just in terms of its practicality, it's not a workable recommendation and would create all kinds of problems and difficulties, not to mention some legal problems for the ELC, a churchwide organization. The recommendation has no integrity whatsoever. None of us would say to our children, you may not go with your friends to the pool hall tonight, and then turn around and in the same sentence say to them, but it's okay if you do it, and there won't be any consequences if you disregard my command and my instructions.
It's having your cake and wanting to eat it, too. I mean, the parent who says to their child, don't go to the pool hall, that's my policy. It stands firm. I have not changed my policy. Oh, and by the way, if you go to the pool hall, there will be no consequences.
Right.
And I pretty much approve of that, too, is at the very least sending a mixed message.
Yeah, it's finally just complete hypocrisy. And people will see it for that. I mean, it's...
But are the synods, those sectors of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, are they seeing that recommendation as hypocrisy, according to the responses that the task force is getting?
Most of them are. I think in that recent news release, only a couple of synod councils completely endorsed all three recommendations. And the two that I think I'm recalling accurately are the Metropolitan Chicago Synod and the Greater Milwaukee Synod. And both of those synods have previously taken very strong positions in support of the approval of homosexual activity. So that's not surprising. But most of the other synod councils and individual responses and even statements from the Conference of Bishops at the time of the release of the task force recommendations, most of those other responses have all raised critical questions about the third recommendation.
So at the level of the pew, at the level of the person who's a member of a Evangelical Lutheran Church in America congregation, if a gay couple comes to an ELCA church, can they have their same-sex union blessed?
Well, there is... We don't have a formal policy about that. All we have is that pastoral statement from the Conference of Bishops, and the Conference of Bishops has no legislative authority within the ELCA, so it's pastoral advice.
Are they as likely to find a pastor who says, sure, let's set a date, as they would who says, no, I cannot bless a same-sex union?
It's hard to answer that, Todd. I would hope that most ELCA pastors, if they were in that situation, would say, no, I won't do it, and no, I can't do it. And I hope that they would do so, not only because of the advice from the bishops, but on the basis of the scriptures. But to be honest, there are a number of ELCA pastors who would... would have not a problem at all with doing that blessing, and a number of them have already done it.
And would they, in that case, perhaps even have the approval of their bishop in doing that?
Yes, in some cases it's going to be pretty explicit approval. In other cases it's going to be kind of tacit approval. But the Greater Milwaukee Synod, for example, and I think there are a couple others, they've already adopted a formal position as a synod in their assembly that they approve of the blessing of same-sex unions.
Is the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America currently ordaining to the pastoral ministry active non-celibate gays and lesbians?
The official answer out of our denominational headquarters in Chicago is no, but the truth is that it's been happening for years. There are several different situations. You have some situations, for example, here in Minneapolis and St. Paul, where some openly active homosexual people have been ordained without the approval of the local synods and the ELCA, and those ordinations are not recognized by the ELCA, so those individuals are not on our clergy roster, and some minimal discipline has been taken against those churches, although most of those sanctions have even been lifted. And then there are undoubtedly some actively homosexual people who have kept it somewhat hidden that they're active sexually in a relationship, homosexual relationship, and yet there are some individuals within those synods who know about it, and in some cases everybody knows about it. It's not hidden. It's pretty public. All you have to do is start either listening or, in some cases, going to some of those churches' websites, and you'll see from what the pastors are preaching in their sermons and posting on their websites that everybody knows that they're in an open homosexual relationship. And that's certainly known by the leaders of that synod. There's a group called the Extraordinary Candidacy Project, which is a part of the Lutherans Concerned North America, which is the pro-homosexual lobby within the ELCA, and they acknowledge several people who are on the roster of the ELCA and are in open relationships.
I've been to their website. The names are available, the congregations are easily found, and when you go to those websites, it's often the advocacy is very open
right. On
this issue. Let's talk with Herman, who calls from Illinois. Herman, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask Pastor Chavez, in terms of the situation of active homosexual clergy on the ELCA roster and the seminary situation, is in this special candidacy group, is there a tacit, overt, and covert move on the part of administrators in the seminaries and these Lutheran Concern and the special advocacy group to promote more homosexual applications for ministerial appointments and candidacy in the ELCA? It seems like right now they're talking about 100 who are on the roll. I think the ELCA has about 10,000 active pastors, and that's about 1%. It really seems to make a lot over really a small number of people, and I see that the implications of this is that the ELCA has just about surrendered any claim to be moving towards any genuine description of Lutheran unity, and even in the ecumenical sense as well, by venturing into this.
Herman, thank you very much. Your thoughts there, Pastor Chavez.
Well, it's certainly the stated public goal of the Extraordinary Candidacy Project and Lutherans Concerned North America to increase the number of openly homosexual pastors on the roster of the ELCA. And I think there are some synod candidacy committees, which are the committees that you have to work with in order to get approved to go to seminary and enter the process, who clearly have been stacked by the synodical leadership in favor of that, and so they would not only know about an openly homosexual candidate, but would gladly give their approval. And yes, there are at our seminaries people who certainly favor that that activity and those changes in our denomination, and yet there are also some who oppose it. So it just depends which synod you're at, and it also probably varies maybe a little bit from one seminary to the next.
With only a minute here, two quick questions. Has Presiding Bishop Mark Hansen weighed in on the sexuality report or on those gay advocacy groups within the ELCA?
The most that he said is in that recent news release in which he quotes Craig Nesson. He hasn't directly commented on the task force recommendations. What he is saying, of course, is that, and all the bishops are saying this, that they're hoping that in spite of the obvious disagreement within the ELCA, that we can continue to work together and keep discussing these matters. But he so far has avoided any direct comment that I'm aware of anyway.
And then
the actual recommendations.
Is it too simplistic to think that the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America is being run by a hierarchical bureaucracy in Chicago that is out of step with the average layperson in that church on these issues?
It's not only not too simplistic, but it's accurate. And a questionnaire on church governance that was requested by the Church Council of the ELCA confirms that to a great extent. The responses they got show that that many members of the ELCA view the churchwide organization as being disconnected from churches and synods, and there isn't a high level of trust in the churchwide organization.
Pastor Mark Chavez is director of a reform group within the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America called Word Alone. Their website, wordalone.org, wordalone.org. Pastor Chavez, thank you for being our guest.
You're welcome, Todd.
I don't know, folks, I have not been encouraged on this, not on this update, not what I heard recently from the presiding bishop there of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, Mark Hansen. He gave a speech recently in which he said, well, you know, in 15 years, we're going to look back on this whole issue of gay ordination and same-sex unions, and we're going to laugh. We're going to laugh. We're going to say, what was the big deal? Why were we all so worried? Why did we think it was going to divide the church? It won't prove, he says, to be that big of a deal. Well, as I said before, for the sake of the troop, one hopes that it does turn out to be a real big deal, because the truth is at stake. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.